whatsoever, but your background slides are for a second week in a row. I decided just to feature Corinth since we've been thinking about it in the general vicinity of Thessalonica and all that. But this is the Acro-Corinth, just so you know, an amazing mountain that is overlooking this, the Gulf of Corinth, where the city itself is down here in the lowlands. If you can, it's hard, but it's only 7 miles across there in the background. Somewhere right in here would be the water again, so that it was a main shipping port, Xincria on the other side, where you would use logs to roll ships across that 7 mile plain and save them an enormously dangerous and long journey, around the peninsula there. So all the slides will feature, though, this Acro-Corinth, and an amazing place. In various ones of these pictures, you'll see more of all of these structures, most of which are what we would call medieval. But believe it or not, armies and various kings have been building on that mountain so as to have a fortified, location over Corinth and over that obvious shipping lane circumstance since the time of Daniel. 2,500 years ago, in the 500s B.C., they'd been building fortifications on that mountain. So they won't have anything directly to do with our lesson tonight, but you'll be looking at various aspects of the Acro-Corinth there, towering over Corinth itself. We are looking at Proverbs. This is probably the next to the last lesson we'll be having. Excuse me, parables. I keep saying Proverbs. Parables. Probably the next to the last lesson this evening on the parables of Jesus. So please open to Matthew 21. The reading this evening a few minutes ago, thank you, Dean, was from Matthew chapter 21. I want to start way back, though, at verse 23 and pick up a larger part of the context there, and we'll read on through into what was just read aloud. And, of course, see the point there that Jesus was trying to make. The setup, really, in Matthew 21 begins at verse 23. When he had come into the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him as he was teaching and said, "By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority?" Jesus answered and said to them, "I'll ask you one thing too, which if you tell me, I'll also tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John was from what? From heaven or from men?" And they began reasoning among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he'll say to us, then why did you not believe him? But if we say from men, we fear the multitude, for they all hold John to be a prophet." In answering Jesus, they said, "We do not know." He also said to them, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. But what do you think? A man had two sons. He came to the first and said, 'Son, go work today in the vineyard.' And he answered and said, 'I will, sir.' And he did not go. Came to the second and said the same thing, but he answered and said, 'I will not.' Yet he afterward regretted it and went. Which of the two did the will of his father?" And they said, "The latter." Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you, that the tax gatherers and harlots will get into the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. But the tax gatherers and harlots did believe him. And you, seeing this, did not even feel remorse afterward so as to believe him." So this particular parable, as you can see, Matthew 21, begins with the chief priest demanding an answer. Who do you think you are? By what authority? And please note, I find it immensely interesting here. By what authority, they ask, are you doing these things? Well, that would certainly include his preaching. But doing these things immediately includes, and I think really rather features, the doing of things that Jesus was participating in. What was Jesus doing and then preaching? The miracles that we've been studying in such detail here on Sunday mornings, 20 lessons we've had so far. By what authority are you healing the sick? By what authority are you raising the dead? By what authority do you cleanse lepers? By what authority? Can you imagine how just really insane that question is? The authority ought to be obvious. And all of these other people recognized it. And so they accepted his authority. If they didn't have authority, that was at risk because of it. So when Jesus introduces this parable, or when, you know, by which I mean he just speaks the parable, we should be very careful to recognize it clearly is flowing out of the previous challenge. And in that previous challenge, Jesus already in this conversation here has pointed out their failure, has been very much in their face. He's revealed their hypocrisy already. Because he says in verse 24, and I'm going to paraphrase greatly, but I'll tell you what, you answer my question and I'll answer yours. By what authority I do these things, I'll tell you. If you explain to me in 25 the baptism of John, by what authority did he do that? Was that from heaven or from men? They began reasoning, if we say from heaven, he'll say, why didn't you believe him? So what have they just admitted? We don't believe John. They have, these religious leaders, rejected John. John who was prophesied by Malachi. John who should have been so easily recognizable. John who was embraced by so many other people that it looked like, you know, all of Judea was being emptied to go across the Jordan River and out into the desert there just on the north shore of the Dead Sea. You know, they believed him. They sought him out, but not these men, not these religious leaders. And so they answer in 26, they understand, the multitude believed. But in 27, they respond, we don't know. They had a position. He was not from heaven. John was not sent from heaven. The authority of John is not divine authority. So here they are questioning Jesus, by what authority? So all right, you answer an authority question for me, I'll answer an authority question for you. They've admitted in their minds and in their discussion they don't believe in John. Jesus says in 27, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. I know you've refused me. So, what do you think? A man had two sons, came to the first son, go work in the vineyard. He said, I will, but didn't. Second son's asked the same thing. He says, I won't, but he does. So, which of the two did the will of the father? The latter. Yeah, he delayed. Yes, he said he wouldn't, but he recanted, and he went ahead. He did do, even though he said he wouldn't, he did do what his father asked him. Truly I say to you, in 31, tax gatherers and harlots will get into the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. So Jesus now reveals, you know, to them verbally what they've just admitted in their little private consultation and what they know in their heart of hearts, but what their whole lives will have also manifested. They'd not been baptized by John. They didn't believe in John. They wouldn't accept him as a messenger from God. But the tax gatherers and the harlots did. And in 32, he suggests what must have been even more humiliating, even more insulting, as if what he's just said would not just be a towering insult. He says, and I'll paraphrase again now, so not only are the tax gatherers and harlots better than you, wiser than you, and are able to recognize the source of John, which you can't, but they'll get into the heaven or into the kingdom before you, and then you didn't recant when you saw that they were coming in. What this suggests then is that if you would start studying at the feet of tax gatherers and harlots, if you could learn from them, if you would follow their example, and instead of deeming yourself wiser, smarter, you know, more academic and all of this, you're the great power brokers, know all there is to know, yet you just admit, we don't know, which is a lie. You did know that you didn't believe in John, and these tax gatherers and harlots in every single way should be teaching you and you not them. Friendly guy that Jesus was. When You're in a position of responsibility. You're supposed to know better. You've trained your whole life. You're a master, you know, of the Old Testament. You should have recognized John. You should have recognized me. You go ask me by what authority, and if it isn't obvious to you, as it is to tax gatherers and harlots, who you sneer at as being so beneath your dignity, then I'm not going to answer your question either. So he didn't. He never said, by the authority of God. Did he say, by the authority of God? He never said it. Did they get it? Oh, they got it. They got it for sure. So in 32, just let's recap it. John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. But the tax gatherers and harlots did believe him, and you, seeing this, did not even feel remorse afterward so as to believe him. Now Jesus then, and you'll note, it's Matthew 21, we're getting late in his ministry, we're getting close then to that last week, very close before the crucifixion. Is he backing off at all in his teaching, or is he not becoming even more confrontational as he comes down that final road? Even more confrontational. So it does, it enrages them. It's not very, you know, diplomatic, but it's sure getting the job done that you men don't deserve an answer. So in the form of a parable, I ask you this. Can you answer this question? Which one did the will of his father? And the answer is the one that, obviously, did the will of his father. It's not what you say, it's what you do. So Jesus has just dispensed with them. That's the end of this. I'm not even going to answer your question. But there's an immediate follow-up. So you can see it's the successive verses that I've just put up on the screen here. We're going to now read 23 through 46, and we've got another parable that has to do with these evil vine growers. So he specifically says, after such a humiliating public insult and revealing, unmasking of these men's hypocrisy, he says in 33, listen to another parable. I'm not done with you yet. Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a wine press in it, built a tower, and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. When the harvest time approached, he sent his slaves to the vine growers to receive his produce. And the vine growers took his slaves and beat one and killed another and stoned a third. Again, he sent another group of slaves larger than the first, and they did the same thing to them. But afterward, he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the vine growers saw the son, they said among themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize his inheritance." They took him, threw him out of the vineyard, and killed him. Therefore, see if you guys can answer this question, you can hear Jesus say, "When the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those vine growers?" I'm also amazed in this whole context here that these Pharisees could be so foolish as to having just been so horribly, you know, exposed and criticized and just busted, that they'd stand right in there and set themselves up to do it again. You'd think they could have learned from the first one. But here they go. They're going to answer again. I guess they're trying desperately to try to reclaim their dignity. You know, we can answer your questions. So in 41, they said to him, "He'll bring those wretches to a wretched end and will rent out the vineyard to other vine growers who will pay him the proceeds at the proper seasons." Yeah, that's the right answer. So Jesus said to them in 42, "Did you never read in the scriptures, 'The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief corner. This came about from the Lord, and it is marvelous in our eyes.'" Now, by the way, if you don't have, you know, a footnote there, that would be Psalm 118, verses 22 and 23. Did you never read Psalm 118, verses 22 and 23? The rejected stone is the most important one of them all. It's the corner, and it's marvelous. 43, therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and be given to a nation producing the fruit of it. And he who falls on this stone will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust. When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard his parables, they understood that he was speaking about them. When they sought to seize him, they feared the multitudes because they held him to be a prophet. And depending which of the gospel writers that you're reading, there's a number of different places, you know, where you see the rising wrath in these men as Jesus just keeps humiliating them in public in front of everybody time and time and time again. But you can certainly see it here. Now, they've just come to their limit. So at 46, when they sought to seize him, they feared the multitudes. They were ready to kill at this point. They won't be able to for some time, but they've certainly started all their discussions about it. How are we going to pull this off? We don't want to get in trouble with the people. But can you imagine the hardness of these hearts? How corrupt do you have to be to say, hey, we're just wondering, how can you work a miracle everywhere you go in the presence of thousands and you've never failed and you've been doing it for 3 years? Who gave you this authority? Can't figure that out. Well, who gave John his authority? Obvious answer, the same person gave John his authority, gave me the authority. Well, we don't know. Bunch of liars. So he's exposed them once. He just simply does it again. You understand about money. You understand about responsibility. You understand that we are to be servants of our God and to produce fruit to him. We are to go out into this vineyard as he gives us opportunity to be like his stewards, to serve him, to labor for him, to produce for him. That's what we're all supposed to be. And what are you guys? You guys are the murderous renters who don't respect anything that would be normally understood by, let's say, tax gatherers and harlots, but it's supposed to be first and foremost understood by you. You get none of it. So they get what Jesus is saying under the presentation of a parable. There was a landowner. There was two sons. They get it. He's talking about us. He's humiliating us. And he's enraging them as well. So, brethren, we also, though, have the prophecy in verse 43. Therefore, I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a nation producing the fruit of it. Were they in the kingdom of God? Sure they were. So I'd like to spend just a moment here. I think it's important for us to recognize this. We have a tendency to think in terms of there never was a kingdom until Jesus established it in Acts chapter 2. Is that the case? It's really not. Abraham was in the kingdom of God. Moses was in the kingdom of God. They were faithful servants of God. God was their king. As a matter of fact, when they got into the promised land, give us a king like the nations around us. Well, they haven't rejected you, they've rejected me from being their king. God was the king in the Old Testament. The Jews were in his kingdom in the Old Testament. And that kingdom is going to be taken away from them. You can't take anything away from somebody who doesn't have it. So yes, there was a kingdom. Yes, nominally as descendants, direct descendants of Abraham, these men would be in that kingdom. But that old kingdom's going away. And all of you men who are these corrupt leaders in it will be swept away with it. You are these wicked renters. You are the unfaithful son. And you will lose this kingdom of God that you think you know so much about. Well, I'm not going to tell you by what authority I do these things, but I will tell you that you are doomed, is what Jesus says in these two parables. You are doomed in verse 44 to fall over the chief cornerstone. You are doomed then to be broken to pieces. You are doomed, if not that, to have it fall on you and be scattered like dust. But you are doomed because tax gatherers and harlots understand this kingdom a whole lot better than you do. That's harsh. By the time Jesus was coming down, you know, that last lap and into Jerusalem, he was making his point very, very bluntly. Thought I had changed that slide, but I guess I didn't. Chapter 22, we carry right on. Next verse. Verse 1, Jesus answered and spoke to them again in parables. The kingdom of heaven, second time he's used that phrase now tonight, may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son. He sent out his slaves to call those who had been invited to the wedding feast, and they were unwilling to come, just like unwilling to pay in the previous parable. Again, he sent out other slaves, saying, tell those who have been invited, behold, I prepared my dinner, my oxen, my fat and livestock, all butchered. Everything's ready. Come to the wedding feast. They paid no attention. Went their way, one to his own farm, another to his business. And the rest seized his slaves, mistreated them, and killed them. Dare I say, repetition from this morning's introduction. What is different about this from the parable of the evil, you know, vine growers? It's just so very similar. In both cases, brethren, notice repeated invitations, repeated admonitions. You're turning them all down. So in verse 7, the king was enraged, sent his armies, destroyed those murderers, set their city on fire. And then he said to his slaves, the wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Go therefore to the main highways, as many as you find, invite to the wedding feast. Those slaves went out into the streets, gathered together all they found, both evil and good. And the wedding hall was filled with dinner guests. Now, brethren, I surely wish that I might have orchestrated this, having, you know, carefully conceived it about a year ago, that tonight I would bring together our lesson from 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where verse 1 begins with our gathering together to Him, and then very skillfully, with enormous forethought and careful preparation, bring it to you again tonight under the form of these parables. Did I do such a thing? No. But isn't providence and coincidence nice when that happens? So when you're looking at this gathering together in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 1, the natural inclination, I guess, is what's often taught in most churches on the planet, I guess. Well, that must be gathered together, you know, in heaven. I don't think so in 2 Thessalonians. Don't think so here. He's talking about the kingdom of heaven. You know, all these parables he's showing. The people that are in the kingdom now will have it taken away from them. These Jews who have enjoyed all the privileges of being God's chosen people for so long will have it taken away from them. They have judged themselves unworthy of the wedding feast. They will be killed. Their city will be burned. Is that where it all stops? No. You send the slaves out and you bring those in who are worthy, which here the expression is, you gather them. I think it's not a coincidence. The idea of gathering, brethren, is gathering into one. Those who had been divided by the law, gathering together into one kingdom that includes whom? All of those that were originally invited got rid, killed, destroyed the city of those who wouldn't respond to that invitation. And then what do? We go out and we gather into that kingdom of God. All of those. So Jew and Gentile, because you Jews are not recognizing the great gift and responsibility that God has given to you. So, in verse 10, these slaves went out into the streets, gathered together all they found, both evil and good. The wedding hall was filled with dinner guests. But when the king came in to look over the dinner guests, he saw there a man not dressed in wedding clothes. He said to him, friend, how did you come in here without wedding clothes? And he was speechless. Then the king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot, cast him into the outer darkness. In that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen. Which, of course, brings us to the grand conclusion, the lesson, and the end of this particular series of three parables. But ultimately, brethren, what is the point in all of these? With these three parables, is a son just okay because he's a son? Or does he have to do the will of his father? If you're a vine grower renting a field, you better treat the representatives from the owner of that field properly, or you will be destroyed. If you are a king given a wedding feast, you know, then God clearly is the king. He's inviting these people in. They're not going to come. We're going to destroy you and your city. We're also going to invite everybody else who will. But ultimately, brethren, in all three cases, the Pharisees could figure this out, and now I think we are left making sure we figure it out. Are you okay just because you're a son? No. If you're in the kingdom, can you have the kingdom taken away from you in the second parable? Yes, you can. And even if you accepted your new king, you know, the wedding feast and all of this, can you then just coast? Still, there's a judgment scene at the end, isn't there? If you're not dressed properly, if you're not behaving properly, now you get cast out again out of the kingdom. So, brethren, when we're done with these three parables, which all started with, by what authority? Without giving the answer is, by the authority of a living God, and you better believe it. There's judgment coming. I'm offering you my kingdom. Please enter. If you do, you will have to behave like a humble servant. You will have to behave properly. For there will always be judgment for those who will not serve me properly. So it's as much a warning, I think, for us today. We're in that kingdom. We don't want to be cast out of that kingdom. Let's just do the job that is at hand. See, I'm kind of running out of time here, so let me just press on. Matthew chapter 24 now. We come to verses 27 through 34. In Matthew 24, verses 27 through 34. And again, I'm giving you a wider context. And now, for the sake of time this evening, I am going to have to depend upon your knowledge of Matthew 24, which I'll summarize only by saying there is not one word in this entire chapter that speaks of anything other than the events that lead up to and culminate in the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Not one word in this whole chapter is outside those parameters. That's what Jesus is talking about. That's pretty easy to see when you're here in verses 27 through 34. So as we start off in 24:27, he says, "Just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be." Now again, I wish I'd set it all up, great brilliance years ago, you know, and all the rest of that. But we've been talking a lot about this coming lately. It's purely providential. It wasn't intentional. It just, you know, came together that way. But hopefully we've learned a lot about this coming in the last couple of weeks as we've looked at numerous passages that give us time references with regard to this, the second coming of Jesus in judgment against the Jews and the destruction of their city and their temple, precisely like he was just talking about under the figure of the preceding three parables, chapters 21 and 22. So when the coming of the Son of Man, you know, arrives, everybody's going to see it. It's not a thing that's going to be hidden. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, tribulation Thessalonians were living through, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man in heaven will appear. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. They'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. He'll send forth his angels with a great trumpet. And what will they do in verse 31? The gathering. The gathering of 2 Thessalonians 2:1. They will gather together as elect from the four winds, one end of the sky to the other. Now, learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. Even so you too, when you see all these things that we just read, when you see the people that he's talking to, see all these things, recognize that he's near at the door. Same thing James said this morning. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So when you're reading 29 and 30 and 31 and you're seeing tribulation, sun darkened, moon won't give its light, falling stars, powers of the heavens shaken, sign of the Son of Man, tribes mourning, coming on the clouds, our natural inclination, because in America it's been taught for several hundred years, it's permeated our society, it's the zeitgeist, you know, the United States, is that none of that's happened yet. Jesus, when he uttered those words, was quoting from several places in the Old Testament, all of which had already been fulfilled, all of which deal with God sending a physical army to destroy an unfaithful nation, whether that nation is a Gentile or the Jews. They'll be destroyed, and every Jew would immediately recognize that terminology. Isaiah uses it, Ezekiel uses it, other people use it. And back then, it always had to do with one nation destroying another. Had to do with Babylon being destroyed by the Medo-Persians. Had to be, you know, it dealt with Egypt being destroyed and other nations being destroyed. They knew it when they saw it. So here's this language, and it's followed with a parable. Now learn this. The parable is, you can look at a fig tree and tell when something's getting near. And I'm telling you, when you see all these things, then you know he is near. At the door, this generation will not pass away until how many of these things take place? All. It's only a three-letter word. It covers a lot of territory, doesn't it? Until all these things take place. So Jesus is prophesying about a coming judgment in terms they knew full well from their Old Testaments. And this tiny little parable, a fig tree puts forth its leaves, you can tell summer's near. That's the whole parable. It's identified as a parable. It's the parable of the fig tree. Wake up. He's telling these people. Again, only a couple chapters after 22, three chapters after 21, he is still preaching this very same message. Let me hasten on. This will be our last parable this evening. We're still in Matthew 24. I did want to point out, though, this is an artist's rendition of Corinth, beneath the Afro Corinth, in 1847. That was before Polaroid. Okay, so this is an artist's representation. But he stood there then, and it's really fascinating to see. I've shown you all these other photos. You see how it's grown up today and all the rest of that. But here we go again. Just off this way would be the water that you saw earlier. And the other side, you know, as well, with this mountain towering over all the valley right there. So that's an artist's illustration as he stood there in 1847. Unrelated to that, we're going to continue in Matthew 24. Now, watch this, brethren. He's just said in verse 34 that this coming of the Son of Man will take place in this generation. He'd used the phrase coming of the Son of Man. He'd identified terminology that they used. He says in 34, this generation will not pass away till all these things take place. But as you can see, I'm using kind of snippets up there. I'm not going to read it all. But in 37, for the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. And then you can skip down to verse 39. They didn't understand until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Then we'll pick up at 42 and read on down now to the end of the chapter. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. I'm telling you it's going to be in this generation, verse 34. But I'm not telling you what day. I'm telling you in this generation. Some of those standing here will not taste of death. You'll not finish all the cities of Israel, you apostles. The material we studied 2 weeks now in 2 Thessalonians. Be on the alert for the coming of the Lord, 42, because you don't know the day. But be sure of this. If the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert. He would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you be ready too, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not think. Who then, here comes our parable, is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly, I say to you, he'll put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, and shall begin to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, at an hour which he does not know, and he shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall be there and gnashing of teeth. In every case tonight, brethren, in every case tonight, it was the same story, wasn't it? This is an awesome thing, I think. It begins with Jesus just pouncing on those Pharisees, stamping all over them and tramping them into the dust. They're ready to kill him because he treats them the way that he does. But every one of these parables is about what? Serve the Lord while you have the chance. Or what? Destruction is coming, and it's all couched in first century terms. First century terms for these people to respond to. You will lose the kingdom. It's going to be taken away from you. If you're in the kingdom but you don't behave properly, you'll be cast out of the wedding feast, which is the kingdom. And then, in what I often refer to as parabolic drapery, the idea is you're going to be really sorry about it. You'll be weeping and gnashing your teeth if you aren't a part of God's kingdom. It is better to serve God than not. So most interesting to me, how here at the very end of Jesus' life, with the immediate triumphant entry lying ahead now, and then his crucifixion a week later, Jesus is just hammering this thing. Serve the King. Serve the King. Be in the kingdom. Be faithful. Produce for that king. Dress properly or be cast out. You will be cast out. You cannot be in this kingdom unless you behave like a faithful servant. I have one more lesson on the parables then, closing out this upcoming week. And then the elders and I met this afternoon. We've got a whole curriculum that was developed today. Once again, I truly marvel and appreciate the elders' insight and wisdom and choices here. You'll be hearing about it later. But the Sunday morning class will draw to an end in a couple of weeks. Our Sunday morning series on Thessalonians is coming to an end in a couple of weeks. This series is coming to an end next week, most likely. And then we're going to be having replacement, new material and all of those. I want to make my first grand and desperate appeal. Everybody, be with us on Sunday nights as you are this night. Be with us on Wednesdays. We'll be starting Nehemiah this Wednesday. All of this because of the very real love and concern that the elders have in their wisdom for this congregation to feed you as well as possible. Why should you respond to these appeals in this material? Because of five parables you just saw. That's why. Five parables. Stay in the kingdom. Appreciate your attention. As always, we seek to help in any way we can. So if you would, please be standing.